Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. Each week we hold two weekly public meetings, of course here on Sunday mornings, where we take up a theosophical thought or idea that we find prevalent. And this morning we are going to talk about what is theosophy. And that will be our first subject for the month of October. And that entire month will be taken up with theosophy and the theosophical movement. So all of October we will be on that subject. And if you look, November and December are also described in our quarterly bulletin, which has just come out today. And please, everyone, get one and keep it by your side. We also have a Wednesday evening class from 7:30 to 8:30. Doors open at 5:15 and close at 7:15, where the library is open and there's a librarian in attendance to help you with any kind of subject matter you are interested in researching. And then our class begins promptly at 7:30. We are presently just finished the Bhagavad Gita, and we are going to embark again on the ocean of theosophy. And the first class is always the most exciting. Now, we'd also like to remind you that this lodge is just one of many lodges situated throughout the world. And all of these lodges are governed or united under a simple or similar declaration. And the reason that we come together in these classes is stated in that declaration. And if I may, I would like to read that declaration. So says, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In so declaring, we take up theosophical ideas, ideas which are universal in their scope, and as a backdrop, we have the teachings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, which are our guides, so we choose. The subject for this morning is one that we are often asked, what is theosophy? You know, what are you? You're Catholic? What are you, Christian? What are you? Oh, I'm a theosophist. Okay. Now the trouble starts. Now you have to explain what theosophy is. So this morning, we're going to give it a try. And we'll see what we come up with. All right? And we'll ask for your feedback at the end. But we'll have a sort of a perspective historically.
Well, what is theosophy? That we have been asked that question many times, and it seems to perplex people. We try to keep it brief because you don't want to alienate people. We're doing the historical background, so we don't even need to go there. So that's today. When somebody asks you what theosophy is today, that's one thing. But we're talking about, we've been asking this question, what is theosophy, and talking about theosophy through the United Lodge of Theosophists, which was founded in 1909 to get back to the basics, and because it had gone in other directions. Now, in this particular city, we have been asking the question, what is theosophy, since 1925. So, and here we are. But theosophy is actually, we could say it's ancient, but it's more than just ancient, because when one thinks about something being ancient, it's like, okay, well, when did it start? Did it start 5,000 years ago? 10,000 years ago? Well, theosophy would say, in this Manvantara, which is this grand period of evolution that we're in, this grand cycle, that it started 18 million years ago when we incarnated into the forms as mind beings. But really, theosophy is more than ancient, it's timeless. It has always existed and will always exist. It existed prior to 18 million years ago. So we don't even really need to think in terms of time. It is. It always has been. It always will be. But the expression of it is periodical, and the expression changes. The basic ideas and the principles and the ethics remain the same, but languages change, customs change, societies evolve and devolve, they ebb and flow in cycles. Sometimes the philosophy seems all but lost, but it's always kept alive by at least a few, whether they be initiates or masters. There are masters of wisdom that work behind the scenes, and they are the knowers and the keepers of the philosophy. So we try to make it relevant. We always try to make it relevant, but we don't want to make it, we don't water it down, we don't pander to popular prejudices, because if we do, then we're taking away, we're really robbing people of something that is very valuable philosophically and practically in everyday, you know, it is life. Theosophy is life. We can say, what is theosophy? It's a life well lived. It's a life of altruism and service. It's intellectual, but we'll get back to history. There have been many movements prior to 1375. There were the Gnostics around the time of the Christ, or the one known as the Christ. And there was Buddha, which goes back 500 years before Lao Tzu, Confucius, other names that are lost in the midst of time. There were schools that existed, such as in Alexandria, which basically closed in 414 AD, when the school was all but closed with the murder of a great woman adept named Hypatia, who was the last great teacher in the Alexandrian schools. So we want to kind of fast forward to 1375 because it's more relevant to our current cycle. There was a great reformer by the name of Tsongkhapa, who in 1375 gathered up all the adepts of the world. Now, the adepts and masters all know each other, and they can all communicate with one another. Distance and body and distance don't matter. But apparently they did assemble, and it was decided to bring forth the modern theosophical movement, and he reformed the school because Buddhism had degenerated into various sects and various superstitions, and so he formed the Gelugpas, the Yellow Caps, which are in contradistinction to the Red Caps, or the Dugpas, who are really, they got into sorcery and necromancy and whatnot. So he formed a school, and it started the last 25 years. So they started an impulse. They started a pattern, or in a way they made a vow that during the last 25 years of every century, there would be a new teacher or a new impulse, a new impetus, a rising cycle of spirituality and knowledge and fraternity and brothership. And then for the next 75 years, there's assimilation. And so that's the cycle. And so Tsongkhapa was in the 14th century. And then by the 15th century, we saw the Renaissance. And then the 16th century, the Age of Enlightenment. Then the Age of Reason. We see the church authorities, who once had basically all power, and they were church and state, and they had absolute power, and they had convinced the people, because they kept them ignorant and they were not uneducated except for the priests, that that they had the keys to heaven, that they had the power of damning you to eternal perdition if you did not follow their teachings. So over time, people became enlightened. They started looking at the ancient Greek teachings, especially in the West, and they started looking at some of the Roman writers as well, the Neoplatonists. So there was a renaissance, a rebirth of knowledge, and people started, of course, the printing press. That really spread everything like wildfire, because everything used to have, you know, it was prohibitively expensive for anyone to own a book unless you were basically the king or a noble or really, really wealthy. And so knowledge started to disseminate. These ancient ideas, which are timeless, started to filter into the populace. There was scientific questioning. So all the fields of knowledge started to, you know, universities were founded, which none of this had existed before that period of time. Now, of course, as far as the Theosophical Society is concerned, and we don't have time really to talk about, although we would like to talk about William Penn in the 17th century or the founding of this nation in the 18th century. But in the 19th century, since the soil had already been prepared, the first public printed expression of theosophy and the teachers, H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, came upon the scene, and that is what we study. We study their teachings, which were inspired by their masters, and here we are.
It's quite interesting that we would use the word inspire, but that's what theosophy is. It's inspired. It's within us. And we just are gathering the knowledge about us and realizing it. We live in the world of effects. Theosophy teaches us that we have to live in the world of causes. That's how we think. How we think. This is the world in which we must gain mastery. This is what theosophy has pointed out, as well as the Bhagavad Gita, the voice of the silence, that there is a path of great sacrifice, of self-denial, where one must sacrifice the better for the dear. When one must begin to make choices on the very foundation of how we think and how we believe, how we act. Because the foundation of who we are ideas. And theosophy states that there is that which is eternal, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent principle, which is beyond the scope of our understanding, beyond the scope of our imagination, unknowable, unnamed, and to remain that way. That is from which everything comes and which everything is in. There are names for all the parts of this world that we live in, but it is a medium for the soul to grow. And it grows through the physical form, because that is the outward expression of ideas that we have held about ourselves. We manifest that. We need simply to make an intellectual commitment to stay a course. To ever follow that path. Well, we have examples of in the writings of Proculus and Porphyry and Imblichus and Plotinus. These were all students of Monium Saccas. They talk about achieving that godlike state. They talk about it in our Western literature. And it comes through a life of discipline, of purity, of thought, word, and deed. Now, what we say, well, is that possible in the world that we live today? We're not talking about out here. We're talking about in here. You don't have any of these obstacles yet. These are the ones we set up a little while ago that we're experiencing now. But we can set up new ones, new ideas, new possibilities. And theosophy is about possibilities. We are the focal point for a ray of intelligence that we have personalized, but it is not personal because it is shared by each and every one of us. That's what makes us a universal brotherhood with all of life. We're all the same. And the profound realization of that is what theosophy is. We are not separate from anything. We are not, you're not there and I am not here. We have just developed that perception to distinguish, to put limits, to define, to understand what it is that is going on here. Because there's more than just simply bodies sitting in this room. There are minds, mind beings, that are concentrated or thinking along the same lines. And that in itself, we have seen through history, that if leaders are able to channel their members' force and energy into themselves, they become very charismatic. And they become the savior of their people. But that's why we are shown that this philosophy will show you the light. It then becomes your responsibility what you do with that light. Because this light will set you free. That there are no binding forces in our life other than ones that we have imposed upon ourselves. When we were asked to explain what theosophy is, you don't know what the exact words. What is it that you should say that will describe it fully? And it simply keeps, though, they keep on saying, as the first principle, it simply is. It is beyond, it is a single supreme essence, unknown and unknowable. This statement is made through all great religions. There is that which is eternal, and the laws which govern it are eternal. The coming forth and the return, the motion. This is the movement of the universe. This is our movement. If we understand our rhythm of breath, our rhythm of our heart, the rhythm of our day, but we are but a rhythm. And when we are most successful, we are attuning ourselves with the ideas of others that raise us up, that make us stronger rather than being decisive and tearing us down. if you want to know if someone's here to help, ask them. How can I help? How can we help? What can I do? We have people around us, and we say we're a theosophist. Well, what does that mean? The world seems to be going in pieces. There seems to be such chaos. Well, this is the reason why we need to hold fast and keep with these eternal ideas, and that this phasmagoria of life that passes us by, we do not become overwhelmed in. We must live in the spiritual world, the world of cause. And if we choose to live in the world of effects, we never know quite what's going to be coming next. But when you live in the world of causes, you have a control of your life. That's very subtle. It's not overt, but it's very subtle. Well, we'll leave it at that. Now, there's many historical references of this philosophy we haven't mentioned. If anyone has any questions, comments, yes.
How would you recommend understanding the causes more fully or more accurately? And we go through life looking at things happening to us and others, especially. And we know from being students of theosophy that there are causes creating these effects. And I've always been an advocate of understanding the cause before you try to solve the effect, what we call problems or conditions. But it's always difficult to understand what these causes are, because we don't have the full vision, at least I don't, to properly understand that. So how do we go about understanding those causes?
Well, I think we think that you've started it already by questioning, the whole process. We have to reflect. We need to reflect upon our life. We need to reflect upon issues, on things that are going on. But we need to reflect, in a way that is impersonal, to develop that impersonality, because that is how we are able to look at things objectively. Now we say, well, we look at things and sure, we have it all figured out, but it's colored. It's colored by our opinions, by what we want, by what we don't want. Well, that's what we have to work with. We have these little faults and foibles that we have developed. Well, we have to overcome them. That's the burden we're carrying right now. We have personality traits and flaws, but so what? So what? But you can just become aware that they exist. That's all you can do. And then from there, other things will come. You?
Me?
You're next.
Am I?
Okay.
Thank you. The thing that's difficult that we've, for this student and many students, we think it's a common trait, is that we can grasp the basic principles. We may even look at some of the science and the background of metaphysics and occultism, but it's not the intellect that makes us a good theosophist. As a matter of fact, not the intellect is good, but if we over-intellectualize, then we can get into trouble, because it's really, even though it's not as materialistic, say, as the work world, the business world, we can, by being over intellectualizing, we can, in a sense, materialize. It's a higher level of materialism. It's a more ethereal materialism, but it's still material. We can materialize ideas because we're looking at trying to look at concrete examples. And we do learn by analogy and correspondence, and it's very important. But we always have to, if we just keep in mind that we are ceaselessly self-deceived, and just keep that, always keep that in mind, that we're always being deceived by our senses. Our senses deceive us, and our desires deceive us. So if we examine them objectively, if we become the observer, and we're told, become the observer, we are greater than that. We are greater than anything. We are, you know, to be the observer, to look upon the upon things dispassionately and objectively. That's all. Yes.
Well, we heard what you said, and therefore I see what you mean. Is that a form of wisdom? Because having heard what you said, and I see what you mean.
Well, we would think that would be a very good analogy. I see what you mean. It's seeing something is knowing something.
But can any other creature in this entire universe, other than I myself, say what I just said?
Well, we are the only creatures that are able to reflect. To reflect. To stand apart from that which it is. So we have a consciousness, but it is a self-consciousness. That the entire universe is conscious. We cannot forget that. It is, everything is conscious. We are just at that point of evolutionary consciousness where we are self-reflective. We are independent flames of consciousness.
Then we are the only creatures in the entire universe that can say, I am that I am.
We don't know that. We don't know that.
The question is, how do we know that?
Well, by just considering that which is eternal, that which is boundless, that which is immutable and omnipresent. Consider space. Where does it stop? Where does it start?
Well, then that must be God. That must be the wisdom of the Supreme.
It's becoming a dialogue. Excuse me. I said this is becoming a dialogue.
Yeah, we need to. There's no need to
just answer that.
The answer is only a seer, an adept, can see into the very heart of things. And really, they know more about us than we know about ourselves. We think about the Tower of Babel. It's a great story because, you know, really what it signifies is that one time we all spoke one language, we had one thought, we had one religion, and actually things were better before language because we could read each other's thoughts. We could see, we were more spiritual. We come from a spiritual plane. Evolution starts at the high point, and then it, in a sense, it immerses itself in the matter, and then it evolves back up. So we are on the ascending arc, but we have a long, long way to go. And because of language and customs and religions, and just there's just so much information out there, especially nowadays, people are questing, they're trying, everybody is questioning. Everyone wants to make their life, everyone wants to make order out of chaos, we think. We'll just make a general statement. As far as we know, unless they're truly insane or if they're malicious and trying to stir up trouble intentionally. So only a seer and adept can see into the very heart of things. We can't. So there is confusion. I am that I am. That is for everyone can say that, and everyone should dwell on that. In the back, somebody? Straight back.
That process of exploring or knowing I am that I am can start in a very little way, can't it? In other words, if we are experiencing life and finding ourselves in a tizzy, if we stop for a bit and consider what the event was, what the experience was, strip it down to just what happened, then we can pull apart the event as opposed to our perception and story about it, where all the tizzy was. So that process of trying to live in a calm, centered, what's really the event, is that the beginning of this practice that leads to greater perception and ability to see?
Well, there has to be a point at which one says to oneself, what's going on? Why, who's in control here? Who needs drama? Who needs drama? Because it's all created. All the drama is created by someone, somewhere, somehow. And it's always for an end. That it's so... Just be aware that all the drama that we see in life is just that, just drama. Just drama. And how it affects us is how we choose to let it affect us. In the very back.
We're thinking, even though we understand, yes, I am a thinker, there's also a part of things that we get a feeling that this is right. A feeling of knowing this is balanced. This has got to come from somewhere else beside just a thinking machine. We sometimes think that feeling is the real, the feeling to know or see the balance in anything.
Well, I think it's how we started. I think we're inspired. We're inspired. If we can't be inspired, we don't want to live. What? Why are we doing this? Why are we living? For what purpose do we exist? How are we inspired to live? Because we all are. In our own way, we're inspired. We just don't look at it that way sometimes. But we're inspired. And we just need to refine that inspiration. And again, on the causal plane, on ideas, just the ideas. Just read a devotional book. When you get a chance, just read it. You don't feel like going there, but just read it. Just read it. And just force yourself to get into that plane, which we shut out in this workaday world.
Well, we need to learn to get out of our own way, really, because we tend to think that things are real, but there's a lot of, we add a lot of details and a lot of layers to things that probably aren't there, and that's where we can get into trouble. So it's good to ask somebody in a dispassionate way, you know, what they really feel about something and have a discussion. But often in this world, due to our past experience, and often we can get into most, we think we can get into the most trouble with those that are closest to us because we think we really know them. We've got their number. We've got them pegged inside and out. And they're coming, you know, it's like if we're in a certain kind of mood, there's a fog. We're not in the right place. So we should probably just be silent or be compassionate or ask, like, well, what do you mean by that? Without saying, what do you mean by that? That tone, the tone of voice. It's not, what do you mean by that? It's, well, oh, okay, that's interesting. Well, what do you mean by that? In the back?
We were just wondering how these ideas were passed down through eons before they were written down. We're assuming that these ideas are innate in us, that they are there, and that we just need some kind of prompting, some kind of guidance in order for us to actually be aware of what these ideas are. So if they weren't put down, we know there was... you know, there were some of the great philosophers had schools and whatnot, but do we know, like even prior to those schools being organized,
well,
how did that work?
Well, we sat, infant humanity had the teachers, the great initiates, the great philosopher kings, those from the prior periods of evolution came and seeded in us all these ideas. They put into infant humanity the knowledge that we needed, the arts and the sciences and philosophy, and we sat at their feet and we were very devoted, and devotion is a good thing. As long as it's not misplaced. But this is prior to when we started generating all this karma and when we started bad karma, in a sense, and started all the divisions. But as far... So this knowledge is impressed in us. It is innate. It is within us. But it's been covered up. It's been covered up by materialism and selfishness and whatnot over the years. So periodically teachers come to remind us. But as far as the written word goes, this was orally, all this information was orally transmitted, and it took many years. We understand that the training to be a druid was 18 years, and one had to put all known knowledge to memory, so one could be an exemplar and a teacher. It's possible. When we have the printed word, if we read, Mr. Judge did an article, a great article called Much Reading, Little Thought. Often when we have things in print, we read inattentively and we forget. But during that period of time, we didn't forget. We committed it to memory. And it was real. It was more real than the printed word.
We sometimes wonder how can people communicate with the other kingdoms? How can there be a sympathy between the plant kingdom, the human kingdom, or the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom? And science is showing us more and more how man influences all these kingdoms. But there is a natural sympathy that arises in all the kingdoms for us. There's a natural sympathy. And we're able to consume these kingdoms below us so that we can burn it in our furnace and create energy and operate on this plane. But the image that we are given, that we are a flame. And we are consuming everything around us. With the oxygen, with the food, how we eat, we're just consuming it. But that light is what we're trying to capture, understand, use for the benefit of everyone.
From an intellectual point of view, in our modern education system, and we pick up the secret doctrine, the words Theosophia define wisdom of our God. When we begin to study these ideas, beginning with the fundamental, we recall to our mind what some of the elders in our own family taught. And we are amazed. Some never even finished grammar school and some couldn't even write yet. The very things that we hear in this room, we've heard from them before. So much for the intellectual point of view. But we still find in the beginning when we read a definition given of Theos Sophia, thy wisdom. Well, we martyrs need that, whereas our grandparents and great grandparents understood it instinctively. So it would appear that with humility to approach these ideas, and we're given those three fundamental ideas, could we have a synopsis of those, perhaps, to carry with us to counteract our extreme dependence on the intellectual side of things?
You know, we often, when we talk to someone, we wish to elaborate upon ideas that we think will spike their curiosity. But the one thing that we know, that if we really feel this way, that we do unto others as we would have them do unto us, and that we are guided not by the intellect, but by the heart. And we sometimes say, well, you are a fool because your heart put you in a situation where they really took advantage of you. Well, that's good for you. You have to be who you are, because you can't be made into somebody else. And if you are, you're unhappy. You just have to be yourself. And you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So, basically, we're all one. What we do to you, I do to myself. That is truly the law. And we just do not wish to believe it. On this plane of causality, the thoughts that we have toward each other have a binding effect that binds us together, or it pushes us apart. And that which pushes us apart often attracts us back again, because we're unresolved. But that's what life is. We're here to make resolution. And those that are around us are helping us to knock off some of those sharp edges that we have on us, that we sometimes walk into each other and, you know, bruise someone else. But that is not our intention. But the only thing we can say as a human being is that we can only say to you that what it is that you do is okay. You cannot judge someone. You cannot judge a situation. You cannot judge anything. As soon as you do, you have started a problem for yourself. Judge not, lest ye be judged. And that is a strong oath. So, I hear some marbles rattling around somewhere. Does anyone have a question?
Here they are, right here. So as far as the three fundamentals, the three fundamental propositions, well, there are many fundamentals in a sense and fundamental principles in theosophy, but we think the questioner was referring to the three fundamental propositions. And we study these often. Well, we're really always studying them. They're all aspects of the philosophy. It's the basics of the philosophy. And if we don't have a familiarity and a at least basic understanding, then we're not going to get very far in our study of theosophy. So they are deity, law, and evolution. And in a way, there's just one principle, and then there are aspects of that principle, and that principle is deity, that which is. That is the source of all. It is the substratum of everything, and it always exists, whether there's manifestation or there's periods of non-manifestation or pralaya. So we have the source, and then we have a plan or a diagram, which is karma and reincarnation. Karma, reincarnation is the reason. Karma is the reason we reincarnate. We reincarnate for our faults. We are here. We are perfectible. We are not poor, miserable sinners, although with that mindset, that's what keeps us down. So if we examine ourselves and our motives and our actions, and then we make amends and we become other-centered, we want to do what is the best for all. So we have the source, we have a plan or a diagram or a schematic, and then we have the method, and the method is evolution. It's everything is evolving. We are here not only for ourselves, but we are here for all nature. Everything is connected, and by our actions and our perfecting of humanity, then the lower kingdoms move up. All planets are either were or will be man-bearing planets. There is a humanity, and they're all, in a sense, incubators for human perfection. So we are here to evolve so that we will move past this stage as well, because evolution is unlimited. It's we can't imagine it in our finite minds because it is infinite, and we're only given certain details, but we're given everything that we need to know right here and now.
you know, at this stage of evolution, we are becoming conscious creators of the universe. We're becoming conscious creators of the universe. Well, we are unconscious creators at the present time because we are in such darkness. But once we have these truths, we can no longer claim innocence. That we know that that which we sow, so shall we reap. That we carry around with us every day and every moment a perspective on life. That we've stated before and it's never stated enough. We are ever the witness. We are ever the witness. And we can change the whole world, the universe, by just changing one thing about ourselves. One simple thing. We change the universe. So the fight is not outside of us. The fight is within us. That's why we refer to the Bhagavad Gita every summer. We go back there because it is our oasis. Because we try to intellectually understand this philosophy. But we have to try to open our hearts. We have to develop that principle of compassion. Now, it's there in all of us. We know it. It comes forth. We find tears in our eyes sometimes, and we have no idea where they come from, but from sadness that we see around us. So, compassion is the healing force of the universe. That's what Buddha taught. That's what Jesus taught. That's all what all great reformers taught.
But beware of false prophets. And really, that's what theosophy will help. We are, by studying the philosophies, by studying the ethics and the principles, by realizing that we are self-conscious thinkers, that we are that, we are one with that, that deity. We free our minds, and by freeing our minds, then we are not duped by false prophets. So, we have come to the end of the hour. We do just quickly again want to mention that we're beginning a new cycle. It's the Ocean of Theosophy. It's beginning on Wednesday evening at 7:30. And we start with masters and adepts because we start from above. We start at the high point of evolution, and we will be studying that through June. And then we'll begin our Bhagavad Gita cycle again. So the new periodical is here, and it will give us, it's a roadmap for the next 3 months. All of our efforts here are voluntary efforts of time, money, and service. All are needed. Nothing is imposed or implied. Any contribution, whether it be time, money, or service, is needed and appreciated. Meeting is adjourned.